You're probably wondering what is my superpower? It's break dancing. But I'm feeling a little nervous about doing it over here. You know, you might fall into eternal darkness down there. And I'm also feeling a little heavy, so I'm unbalanced apparently, and it's difficult to break dance if you. If you're unbalanced, it's important to have the balance all right. That's physics. So today, this morning, I'm going to talk to you about carbon dioxide, or how to deconstruct this idol that is so prevalent in the culture that we are seeing all around us today. So 4 years ago, I had the privilege of speaking at this conference, and it was a pleasure to meet last night. Some of you had actually been here before. And you remember that I spoke about the nature and the limits of science and how it's necessary for us to appreciate those things. And my theme at this conference this year is very different, and yet obviously it touches on some of the same things. Generations of students, yourself included, have been trained that human reason, if combined with expensive enough computers is and enough money, of course, is going to solve every single problem that faces us, right? If you've got a problem, you just need enough money and you get the smart people together and then we'll solve those problems. That's not true, obviously. But that's the temptation that we have. That's an idol that I would call an idol of power. That kind of thinking that science can save us doesn't abolish religion. It actually establishes a religion that science is God, is in essence, and it's going to abolish all competitors. So what I'd like to do today is remind you of some of the ways, at least one way, in which science has been and can be abused as a political tool, an idol of power, rather than appreciated for what it is. That is a very powerful tool to describe how our world works, with limits and issues and so on, but still a helpful tool. The story for me began in 2006. I went to the fall AGU, the American Geophysical Union scientific meeting. I go there every December. And that year, the plenary speaker, that is the speaker that everybody was encouraged to go to, was the former Vice President Al Gore. And he presented to us, a crowd of about 10,000 PhD scientists, his theory of global warming. And he told us that we need to become evangelists for the world, to save the planet, and so on. And I was a little disturbed by that. That's actually what led me to write my book. Then, the following semester, my university, where I taught in Florida, showed Al Gore's documentary movie 20 times. 20 times in one semester. The movie is called An Inconvenient Truth. So that rang another set of bells to me, because I was going to this scientific meeting year after year, doing my science, minding my own business, just studying space and weather and things like that. And now I was told that I had a duty, a moral duty, a religious crusade is what Al Gore was calling for at this meeting to these PhD scientists, most of them who would consider themselves very, you know, anti-crusades and things like that. And they were thrilled about it. I wasn't. And I wanted to understand what was going on. So I began to study this particular issue. And I taught a course. In the course, I showed my students, in case they had missed the 20 or so screenings on campus, this movie. And I showed them this movie as well, The Great Global Warming Swindle, which I'd highly recommend to you. Well, when it became known that I'd showed this movie, one of my colleagues in the physics department came to me and took me by the shoulder. She said that for me to show this movie to my students was the same as showing them Nazi propaganda. And I don't really react very well to that kind of comment. I asked her, I said to her, well, I'm not an expert in Nazi propaganda. And she assured me that she had studied this in great detail in Finland. And I said, okay, well, that's great. But I don't know anything about that. This is just questioning the standard story that the world is going to burn unless we end civilization as we know. But I'm a college professor, and so you can imagine what I did when somebody challenges one like this. Can you imagine what I did? I wrote a book. And that's because I believe it's possible to have a biblical, well-balanced view of stewardship and conservation, which will deal with critical issues of a healthy environment and development. Both of these things are crucial in life. And so my book analyzes the worldview, the philosophy, the theology, the ethics, and the strategies as well of the green movement. And what I'd like to do today is to talk to you about the kind of science which is related to this, to the quest, to which moves away from the quest of trying to explain how our world works and what our place is in it. Rather, in this green movement, we have this quest to use the authority of science and religion, as it turns out, to achieve political goals. And this is the idolatry of power religion. So, to get the ball rolling, imagine, if you would, a beautiful tropical island. It's a little chilly today, so that might help you. A beautiful tropical island with the palm trees lazily waving backwards and forwards. You're sitting down, just doing your thing, and suddenly, vroom, this bird comes roaring overhead, very loud, huge bird, bigger than you've ever seen before. And it lands with some racket some distance away. So you go running, you race there with all your friends, you come there, and you find that this bird has disgorged a whole bunch of people. There's a whole bunch of men wearing USA on their shirts. They're very friendly. They've built these elaborate structures. They've built a long runway which goes all the way, this path, to the feet of that strange-looking bird. This happened right after World War II. And as time goes by, those natives, they were noticing not only were men coming out here and interesting things, but food. All kinds of interesting food was coming out, fascinating things. The natives who lived on those islands, who actually became friends with those strange men, godlike men, got all kinds of benefits. They got medicines that would heal them. They would get incredible food out of rocks. They would get rain out of the ground. They could shoot and kill just by pointing. It was rather incredible. And we kind of might forget about this. We just assume in the day that we're living in that everything's just wonderful, right? That if you just have enough money and enough scientists, everything's going to be good. You know, 110 years ago, the average life expectancy in this country was 39 years old for men and 42 for women. Right? Some of you are 20. I mean, that's like you're halfway there on average. And so you can see how amazed these natives would be at these godlike strangers. But World War II ended, and the strangers left, and the cargo left as well. And into the vacuum returned the old terrors of sickness and hunger and an angry Mother Earth. And so the fearful natives, they copied planes, here's an example, and they copied runways. They made a hut where a man was sitting with little pieces of wood on his head like headphones and antennas. They'd seen this. They'd seen those godlike people with the USA written on the front of their shirts doing these kinds of things, and then the planes would just keep coming and dumping food from rocks and all kinds of miracles. And so they thought if they did this, they would get the same things. They had an outward form of religion, but they didn't have the power. In fact, they had perfect form. Here's a picture of them drilling. This is still going on today. There's the John Frum cult. It's called a cargo cult in anthropology because they were thinking and hoping that the cargo would come, these ships or these birds from the gods would come. Well, in nearby islands in Vanuatu in the 1800s, the natives also stared in blank bewilderment when John Peyton, a Presbyterian missionary, dug a well, and out of the well came water, which was absolutely mind-boggling to them because they knew This is the fact, the scientific fact. Water only comes from the sky that you can drink. But he brought rain from the ground. Peyton told them that Jehovah my God gave it out of his own earth in answer to our labors and prayers. Rather than making himself out to be God, he gave honor to the Lord God. And these pagans, many of them at that particular island, turned to God. And you can find them today still worshiping God in some of those islands. And on others, you find them looking forward to waiting for the gods to come again and unload the cargo. And their knees shook in both cases. Because in pagan cultures, there's a fear of animals, there's a fear of trees, the restless Mother Earth. You know about this. If any of you've watched any movies, right? They have familiars, spirits that are associated with animals and so on. People fear them. You know, you're not going to kill the mouse in Greece. A mouse is a power animal related to the god Apollo. You don't want to just kill the mouse. You feed it, just like you feed the rat in Hindu culture. They fear, because any small action may anger the gods. You're not quite sure, and if there's 300 million gods, or if there's gods you don't know, it's like you just don't know whether you're going to mess up one day and anger some god and be in trouble. Peyton wrote the following, quote, "They worship the spirit. They worship the serpent as a spirit of evil. That is to say, they lived in abject terror of his influence. And all their worship was directed towards propitiating his rage against men." The rage of the serpent was coming down, and they wanted to deflect that rage. And that's why they worshipped. Now, what I've described in World War II era Vanuatu is something that Richard Feynman, the celebrated Nobel Prize winning physicist, and Nobels in physics do mean something, he said it's increasingly happening in our so-called scientific age. In his 1974 Caltech commencement address, he explained how it's possible for professing scientists to be going through the motions of scientific rituals and not actually doing science. You see this all over the world today. It's big, right? The health food movement, for instance. Somebody read something and they've got this idea, and now there's pages and pages. You can click the links and go on for hours about how you need to have this or you have to have this, and so on. It looks like they're doing science. It's reminiscent of cargo cults. They're using some of the same words and techniques. They've got lab coats and equipment, only to discover that in many cases, they've simply deceived themselves. They're doing cargo cult science. And cargo cult science is an idol in our world today, not just on those websites that I mentioned, but in this context as well, which you would never think. A huge context. Scientists at the highest level are involved in it, and you face it. That's why I wanted to tell you about it. You face it in school. It's in Christian curriculum. If you homeschool, it's in many of them too. They push this. They may not realize it, but many of the people who've written the books have been trained in the colleges, where it's definitely being pushed in a very, very heavy way. And then it comes through little by little. We absorb, unless we're very, very careful, as we've been hearing in some of the talks, the culture that's all around us. So, cargo cult science, according to Feynman, is to kind of be going through the motions. It looks like you're doing the right thing, right? Like somebody looks like they're painting, and you come there and it's just garbage. They're not really doing it. It could be also that they're trying to produce a particular result. They've already decided what the result is, and we're just going to cherry pick. We're going to find the results. Or maybe they're true believers. They really, really believe this stuff. They really, 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 really believe it. And then they fail to ask critical questions. You know how it can be? It's just like, don't trouble me with the truth. Something gets too uncomfortable. I just don't want to hear anymore. You know, there can be a legitimate reason to move away. But there also are times when we just don't want to be troubled with the truth. Or maybe it could be because they fear. You could imagine on those islands where the cargo cults were, and somebody said, so-and-so is my friend, and they're related to the god, don't anger my friend, you know, give me all your money, or whatever it may be, or I'll tell my friend, and he'll point his stick at you, and you'll die, just like that. So sometimes people fear to ask the hard questions because the donor funding their research might find those questions unacceptable. Fear is a powerful motivator. What we have is what I would call the global warming scientific federal complex. It's an example of cargo cult science. Experiment first, conclusions afterwards is the usual basis. You don't, in science, conclude before you do anything, right? I think the sky is pink outside. It's pink. You go and you do the experiment. You recognize your uncertainties. You quote them. In the old days, it was very hard to talk to scientists because they'd never give you a straight answer, it seemed. You'd ask them something and they'd say, well, it depends on this and it depends on that and it's like maybe this. And very different today. Cameron, be quiet, please. So, in global warming, the conclusion is predetermined. And in this country, billions, tens of billions of dollars have been thrown into studying global warming. Even before his inauguration in 2008, this is what was reported of President-elect Obama. Fox News, they said, quote, President-elect Barack Obama could be the nation's first green president, whether he likes it or not. The Greens' early investment in Obama's political soul has matured, and they are already angling for and even demanding payback. End quote. This area of atmospheric physics and science used to be, you know, pretty well funded, small area, pretty small. Energy was much more important, but it was not funded to the extent that it is today. In 1993, federal funding in atmospheric science was $2 billion or so. In these are constant numbers. By 2011, it was as large as the entire federal government's budget was in 1932, $4 billion. And it was $12 billion by 2014. President Obama's American Recovery and Reinvestment Act in 2009 topped that up with an additional $26 billion. For climate change programs and activities. That's a pretty good return on investment, if you ask me. The former White House science, not economic, right? The former White House science advisor, John Holdren, said this, quote, this is his goal. A massive campaign must be launched to de-develop the United States. We must design a stable, low-consumption economy in which there is much more equitable distribution of wealth. Whatever that is, it's not science. Well, late in 2009, I believe it was, there were leaked emails from a British climate lab, and it showed, when people read these emails, there have been books written about this now, that global warming scientists had engaged in systematic manipulation of scientific process, obfuscation, and sometimes outright lying. They would prevent papers from being published if somebody published something that didn't agree with, you're not going to get published. Because what happens is scientists write the paper, you send it in, and then your peers review it anonymously. And they say, no, we're not going to let this stuff get published. And several scientists associated with the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, including several from NASA, are implicated. And they were caught red-handed. One of them, Phil Jones, caught red-handed because the emails were saying terrible things. It was called the Warmergate scandal. Dr. Phil Jones, when he was confronted with his emails, yeah, he is publicly saying the world is going to burn unless we end the world as we know it. But his emails were saying, how can we hide the fact that it's not burning, it's not getting worse, etc., etc. He then publicly admitted, Phil Jones, that there had actually been no global warming for almost two decades. And that's really startling. Very startling, if any of you have been reading any of this stuff, because in its celebrated 2007 assessment, the IPCC, in which Jones played a pivotal role, it said that the evidence that the world was and would continue warming was unequivocal. The thing about global warming is that it's the sum of all fears. If you're scared about things, if you don't sleep well, this is like the ultimate. It should be, because the way you hear about it in the media is that it embodies all of the ecological disasters, right? Just think of all the disaster movies that you can think about. Every single one that you can imagine, it's all global warming to take care of it. It's a splendid paradigm, really. It's a catch-all. It's seemingly able to explain anything. So let's just take a look at a few news reports. I mean, who would have thought that global warming could lengthen the day? I mean, it's not, but this is what was published, by slowing down Earth's rotation. It has also, global warming, caused the death of the Loch Ness Monster. It has increased Italian suicide rates, birthed two-headed turtles. If you see a two-headed turtle, it's because of global warming. I don't know. It could be that savvy scientists realize that if you really want to study something and you really are into that, like maybe you're into the mating habits of the rare southern squirrel or something like that, nobody's going to give you any money to study that. It's like, yeah, go ahead, knock yourself out. Nobody's going to give... I'm going to study the mating habits of the rare southern squirrel with reference to global warming. It's like, oh, well now. And so you get these papers. If you can connect it to global warming, there's money. Or maybe some people really, really believe this. I mean, I don't know the motives behind it for different people. It's different motives for different people. But one of the things that's amazing that I want you to note is that whatever the motive is, the ability to explain everything, this is a characteristic of cargo cult science. The political possibilities are endless and appreciated. I mean, you guys could actually take advantage of this if you're smart about this. You know, you could just say, I'm sorry, you know, it's all your fault. Global warming ate my homework. I don't want it to be this way. In fact, I have nightmares about it. But so for a large number of people, this whole global warming thing is just a wonderful tool to achieve certain political ends. For the idol of power, system change is the point, not climate change. This is the kind of thing, if you've ever been to any climate marches or seen reports on it, you'll see people walking around like this with the red Soviet, you know, power fist for the Communist Party, and you think, what does that have to do with global warming? Well, let me see if I can explain to you. A few years ago, I posted this on my Facebook page. It's from the Independent newspaper in the UK. And in the report, the reporter said, quote, snow, a thing of the past in Britain because of global warming, say top scientists. The effects of a snow-free winter in Britain are already becoming apparent. According to Dr. David Viner, a senior research scientist at the Climatic Research Unit, the CRU, of the University of East Anglia, within a few years, winter snowfall will become a, quote, very rare and exciting event, end quote. Children just aren't going to know what snow is, he said. Well, I started getting shocked responses from my friends, some of whom live in Britain. How could all of these top scientists, geniuses, all associated with the United Nations, not see all that global warming falling from the sky? That report, I didn't put the date on there, that was the key that they were missing. That report here is from the year 2000, when alarmists assured us that the science was settled and there was no more snow. You're not going to get any more snow. It's like, you're never going to see it. It's just a rare thing. However, in that particular winter, Britain experienced its coldest winter, second coldest December in 350 years. But, guess what? The world's top scientists now explain that the extreme cold and the snow makes sense. Guess why? Guess. Yes, that's right. That's right. It's totally surreal. And this is why it's very helpful. Some of you are not yet 20 years old. Some of you, very, very, very few, are over 50. In the 1970s, the government in this country was actually holding congressional hearings about Ice Age and what are we going to do? This ice going to cover New York, etc. People forget about all these things, and we just think that what we hear with our little blinkers like a horse in a race, this is all that's happening. And if we are not cognizant of what people have spoken about in the past, you've heard this before, right? If you don't learn from history, you're doomed to repeat it. In the 70s, they were talking about massive global cooling. We're going to have glaciers covering New York again. What can we do? Congress held hearings. CIA has reports. It's in my book. You can read about that. And now they're saying we're never going to have snow again. We're never going to have snow. You don't remember that if you're less than 18, right? It's 2018 now. This first report was from the year 2000. So if you read that, and you, well, if you were 22, you wouldn't have read that, but let's say you're 32, you would have read that, and now you're here a few years later, heaviest snows in history and so on, and it's also because of global warming. You'd go, wait a second, you just told me, you're the world's greatest scientist. I mean, you know what you're talking about. This is, it's surreal. It doesn't matter, in other words, whether it snows or not. Global warming is global cooling, it's climate change, it's climate crisis. The words keep changing, but it's always in the same direction. And that is a hallmark of idolatry. When idols reign, we are returning to the age of magic. I just blame everything on that. It's a bad thing, according to God. And I believe we are, as a culture, prone to this because of a loss, ultimately, of faith in Jehovah. In paganism, what matters most is not truth, but power. And in a very strong sense, we see the paganization of society leading to the paganization of science and politics. These things are symptoms of something that's going on inside the heart. And it affects you directly, as I mentioned, in textbooks and so on, but also because in idolatry of power, the state becomes savior. The state becomes savior, and in the end, salvation requires some pretty severe sacrifices, doesn't it? Sacrifices to the idol. Uncle Sam wants you. Think further history. Ancient Rome. Christians became a problem. Why? Well, because people who've experienced liberty need strong motivations to give liberty up. You bow down before the idol. No, I won't. Then you die. Or you lose your job. Or people call you a Nazi. Or whatever other name they can think of. These people who wish to impose state power to save the planet, right? This is the strong motivation that they give you. You have to do it to save the planet. You can think of situations where you would take really strong action, like if the alarm goes off right now, right? Strong action. There's a fire. We're all going to die. Salvation from disaster is a strong motivating force. But if they keep crying wolf, if you actually appreciate the history, you begin to see through things. Or if you have some theological underpinning which helps you see what's going on, that helps too. In his Nobel Peace Prize, which the former Vice President Al Gore won in 2007, he said the earth has a fever and the fever is rising. Right? There's the strong motivation, he says. He said, we must make, quote, rescue of the global environment the central organizing principle of the world community. Right? You need to put this in every single one of your thoughts. As Christians, if you're a Christian, you know that you're supposed to place the Lord. You take every thought captive unto the obedience of Christ as central. Gore is saying, no, salvation of the environment must be the central organizing principle. And it's going to take lots of political action. He admires China, red China, because he says they can just do stuff. They can save the planet. They can just make people do stuff. One square to use at toilets. Or two squares. The government can just make it the law. He says we cannot be saved without turning over life to expert controllers, and they will show us the path to salvation. That's a romantic view. It's a utopian view. If you heard that before, the story of Utopia is an interesting story written. It's a romantic view. It's idealistic. But that kind of thinking is no guarantee whatsoever of a peaceful or a good soul. If we think about the history of the 20th century, the bloodiest century that we can think of in terms of man-on-man killing, who are the big monsters that we can identify? Now we can. After the fall of the Soviet Union, a lot of stuff was declassified, but American intelligentsia in the 20s were talking about how wonderful the Soviet Union was. It's just idyllic. Everybody's equal and free and fair. It's marvelous, etc. But we see, no, we have people like Mao Zedong in China. He was, I would say, the biggest monster of the 20th century, even more than in the Soviet Union. And he was called the Great Agrarian. There are pictures of him everywhere, gardening and shoveling and doing all those things, because that's right. That's what's good, back to nature. Stalin was called the Great Gardener. The Great Gardener. Adolf Hitler was a vegetarian, an avowed vegetarian. Did you know that? No smoking, no smoking. It was banned in Germany long, long, long before, because Hitler was opposed to that. Rudolf Hess, he's the deputy Führer. If Hitler had, you know, died and there was a pass of power, Hess would have been second in command. He was an environmentalist fanatic. He was vegan. I mean, this is a little unfair, but I'm tempted next time somebody tells me, oh, I'm vegan, I don't eat that. I say, oh, like Hitler. It's like, oh. That's totally unfair. You shouldn't do that, but the history of the world shows that grandiose schemes, nice words, etc., the desire to create this idol of an ideal society, they don't end well. They don't end well. The Christian view instead is that, you know, there are hard realities to deal with. You're a sinner. I'm a sinner. It's not like you're wonderful and I'm wonderful. No, you're a sinner and I'm a sinner. When we need systems in place that will recognize that and manage it and make sure that we're watching one another and, right, being careful. Human nature should make us distrust these ideologies that profess to save the entire cosmos. So now, I'd like to turn to some technical scientific details so that you're not disappointed. A little bit of science as well to show you one way to deconstruct this idol. Science is our friend. Science is abused as an idol of power. That's a terrible thing. And I'm so sorry to say that in greater Christendom in the United States, many Christians have seen that and they've walked away from science because they think that it's obviously therefore evil or bad. And that's not true. It's the idol of science, the idolatry. You're right. It's just like food is not evil just because some people are gluttons. They're making idols of different things. Doesn't make that thing in itself bad. Science is a wonderful tool, and in fact it can be used as a weapon to cut down the power idol. And so let's use it in a very, very small way. I'll show you how. I'd like to talk about the so-called satanic gases alleged to cause catastrophic global warmings. The story of global warming or climate change, or climate crisis, as it's called today, is the story of carbon dioxide. And what's the symbol for carbon dioxide, folks? CO2. One carbon atom, two oxygen atoms. So what are the facts? Environmentalists are panic-stricken, and the reason is they say carbon dioxide will cause catastrophic global warming, but the panic about it is that carbon dioxide is a product of life. You're breathing it out just now. The Green Worldview teaches as well that the consumption of energy, materials, and chemicals accompanying economic growth, technological change, and free trade, these are all mainstays of modern civilization. They degrade human well-being and environmental well-being. Right? These lights have to go off. The air conditioning's got to be shut off. All of this stuff is killing the planet. Because all of this is producing CO2. That's what you're told all the time. And it's because of human beings. The global population is expected to grow 50 to 100% this century. And to some people, that is absolutely terrifying. And I'll talk about this on Thursday, the Lord willing. So the solutions proposed by green politicians are cut population, hamstring the economy, right, cut the economy down, or thirdly, cut access to electrical power. That's a good thing. All of these things will amount to the same thing. Less carbon dioxide is going to be produced. At the United Nations Climate Change Conference in Copenhagen, population control was raised by Zal Bage. This is just one of a thousand examples that I could give you. She is the Vice Minister of National Population and Family Planning Commission of China, the NPFPC. According to Zhao, since the institution of China's one-child policy in 1979, 400 million babies had been aborted in China. And she said, she had worked it all out with the science, that has resulted in 18 million tons less of carbon dioxide emissions every year. And she was coming to this conference on climate because she wanted credit for that. She wanted praise and carbon credits. Aborting humans, she suggested, was actually the most cost-effective way to saving the planet. A much bigger bang for the buck than driving a Prius, which is really just virtue signaling. Kill people, that's more effective. She didn't quite say it that way, but that was exactly what she meant. But the question is, what if carbon dioxide is actually not a problem? So let's look at the connection between carbon dioxide and global warming. I think the connection is not so much scientific as political and spiritual as well. So carbon dioxide is a natural trace element, right? One carbon and two oxygens. It's part of respiration. We're breathing it out right now of all living creatures, virtually all. It's essential for the survival of life on this planet. Plants need carbon dioxide to grow. It's their food and conduct photosynthesis and make food for other creatures to eat. And in fact, carbon dioxide has a massive fertilizing effect, which is very well known. It's so well known that people will actually pump it into greenhouses. If you're trying to grow food, you're going to pump carbon dioxide in. So a certain amount of carbon dioxide is really good, and growing plants with carbon dioxide in a greenhouse is a gardener's dream come true. It's like you'll grow the greatest things you've ever grown before. But you want your plants to be optimum, so if you've got your greenhouse, these are some of the factors that you're going to try to maintain. You want to keep nice steady temperature, because then seeds can be started earlier, you can grow exotic plants, you can winter over plants, you can grow plants all through the year. It's incredible. 80 to 85 degrees is a good temperature. That's about the temperature of Mexico, if you ever go there. It's just like 80 to 85 all the time. And so what happens is the greenhouse temperatures are generally kept constant by radiation from the sun coming through the glass in the top. And you've got windows. You can see them. You'll open them and close those to try to control the temperature. So electromagnetic radiation from the sun will warm things up inside there. And then you want to keep it humid, so you'll add a little bit of water. And then gardeners discovered that plants actually grow better as well if you're pumping carbon dioxide. And the carbon dioxide for gardeners has nothing to do with heating. It's everything to do with plant food. So that's why so many gardeners indoors and outdoors will use carbon dioxide to supply plants with this essential building material. So what does the plant do over there? It takes that carbon dioxide out of the air, and it uses that to build stems and leaves and fruit and so on. It accelerates growth and increases fruitfulness. Plants also are better resistant to pests like mold and other things with increased carbon dioxide concentration. So carbon dioxide is plant food and it's plant medicine. So concentrations of carbon dioxide are listed in parts per million. Parts per million. If you ever see ppm, that's what people are talking about. Do you have any idea what the major constituents? There's two major constituents of the atmosphere that we breathe are. Nitrogen? Okay. Nitrogen and oxygen. We've got about 78% nitrogen and 21% oxygen. And then there's another 1%. What's that? Argon. Yeah, another 1% argon. If you add those three numbers up, that's 100%. So it's nitrogen, oxygen, and argon, and then trace amounts, like total little amounts. So if we had this room filled with colored balls, red balls and green balls, we would have tons of red balls and tons of green balls, and then we'd have 1% of some other color, and then very, very rare, very, very hard to find, we'd have trace elements. And carbon dioxide is one of these trace elements. So its concentration, it's so rare, is measured in parts per million. It's like adding one gold coin, in this case a fake one, a bitcoin, to gold coins. That's one part per million. So scientists and gardeners know that if you want to grow things really well in your greenhouse, you need to have the carbon dioxide concentrations above 700 to 900, maybe 800 would be a nice number to start at if you want to grow beautiful flowers and so on. Roses are interesting. Roses grow best at 1,200 parts per million. You can do the experiments. Put them in there, lower the carbon dioxide concentrations, raise it, change the temperatures, change the humidity, do different things. But roses grow really, really well at 1,200. So if you want to try grow roses outside, friends, you're not going to get the best roses in the garden. You're going to get the best roses. If they say it's greenhouse growing, you'll say, oh no, I only want to have organic, natural roses. Well, if they're greenhouse roses, they're going to be the most healthy, beautiful roses, because it seems that roses are starved if you grow them outside, because the carbon dioxide concentration outside is far, far less than 1,200 parts per million. So fruits and vegetables seem to grow very well at 1,000. So if you want to get some numbers, think about that, 1,000. There's evidence, actually, that the carbon dioxide concentrations that we experience now ambiently outside are actually low. And that's, as I said, what gardeners have discovered. You want to pump in, increase the concentrations of carbon dioxide. It's better for plants. So if you want to be green, increase the carbon dioxide concentration. We could make an argument that for a healthy planet we need more, not less, carbon dioxide. And if you didn't know it already, you know that obviously too much of something can be bad. Too much carbon dioxide will be bad. It will kill you. Too much oxygen will kill you too, you know. Even water can be dangerous. I just want to read this news report. The city councillors of Aliso Viejo in Orange County, California are well-meaning, socially responsible people. And when they came across the huge threat posed to their constituents by dihydrogen monoxide, they did what any elected official should do. They took steps to protect their community. The legislature proposed banning the potentially deadly substance. It's tasteless, it's odorless, a thimbleful will kill you. It's the most poisonous substance known to mankind. It's everywhere. It's in everything. Do you know what dihydrogen monoxide is that they were seriously debating banning? That's H2 dihydrogen monoxide. It's H2. They were considering banning H2O in California. This is not a joke. I'm serious. The sum of this stuff is so funny that it almost seems like a joke. But it wouldn't be funny if they banned water. Right? People would die. People would suffer. And so on. But the point that I'm trying to make here is that obviously, actually, everything's poisonous. There's nothing that's not with a double edge in our world. The issue is that we need to be realistic about it. The dose determines the poison. You know, if you have too much water, forget about choking on it, you'll drown to death, and so on. So how high can we go in carbon dioxide? When people say it's pollution and it's poison, yeah, okay. You know, if you want to be technical, then H2O, dihydrogen monoxide, is also a poison. But nobody would ever talk like that. They're trying to use scare words. Carbon dioxide is not poison and it's not pollution. It's the gas of life. It's not the satanic gas. But too much is going to kill you. It's bad for you. So how high can you go? 600 to 800 parts per million. What is that? That's a very, very well ventilated house. I mean, like holes in the roof. That's what you've got. 600 to 800 parts per million. 1,000 parts per million, that's typical for a closed room. The concentrations in year are going to be probably higher than 1,000 right now. Probably a lot higher than 1,000. 2,000 parts per million. A single person in a closed bedroom without ventilation for 4 to 8 hours. You woke up this morning, there were some satanic gases in the room, I'm sure. But it wasn't carbon dioxide. The concentration, if four people in a room, right, some of the dorms, it's probably 2,000 parts per million. That's probably what you have. The United States EPA actually said that that's a hazard, right? I mean, they would have to start banning rooms with more than four people in them. 5,000 parts per million, that would be a stuffy room. Right, you would experience yawningness and drowsiness. If any of you were like me when I was a child, I would be absolutely terrified of the dark. So I would pull the blankets over my head, and I'd have it, and then I'd start suffocating. It's like, and stick a straw out and do this kind of thing. I was breathing way more than 5,000 parts per million under my blankets. Okay, it's not dangerous. I would start yawning. It would be stuffy. And so on. So that's 5,000. 8,000 parts per million. That would be a poorly controlled greenhouse. If you walked into that, you'd feel like you're on top of a mountain. You'd be going, okay, I'm really working here. I'm working out. You'd still be okay, but you'd be having to breathe rapidly. Okay, question for you. I do this with my students. Who says A? Who says, yeah. Oh, peer pressure is getting to you. I saw the hand go like this. Like, okay, no. Who says A? B. Okay. C. Okay. D. Okay. One thing you should learn in science is majority rule doesn't mean you're right. All right? Majority rule does not mean you're right. However, in this case, you are. 150 parts per million would result in massive plant extinction. Now, the good news is that even for levels over 6,000 parts per million, the carbon dioxide discomfort that you feel, you walk in and you start breathing like, it's like I've had a good workout, but I'm breathing heavily. It's totally reversible. You just breathe. You walk out the room, right? If you're in a stuffy room, it's not a problem. It's totally reversible. The air we breathe out, guess what? 40,000 parts per million. So if you're sleeping next to somebody in a bed and they're breathing on you, they're breathing 40,000 parts per million of carbon dioxide onto your face. Nuclear submarines. If you're a nuclear submariner, they're underwater for months at a time. Guess what the levels are inside nuclear submarines? 5,000 to 8,000. Parts per million for months at a time. Way, way higher than in this room right now. So, let's look at some data. Try to stay focused. Try to stay focused. It's a bit of a mess, and I could fake things and make it look less messy, but I'd rather just show you the mess. This is my attempt to try to show you the relationship between carbon dioxide and global warming. These are thermometer temperatures. And we have global warming and global cooling. You see the thermometer temperature showing things going up and down. Now, I told you that people thought that there would be irreversible changes. There was going to be massive problems because of global cooling in the 70s. But in the 70s, if you look carefully here, this is around about here, the cooling stopped. It was only a few years of cooling that people were terrified about, but it stopped, and there was warming since the 70s. And so that upward trend was the cause for all kinds of drama from the late 1980s. How does one decide whether you have a real crisis, though? How do you decide? Again, is CO2 really this dangerous thing? When is it a stampede to go... Well, when is a stampede a good thing? For you to go racing out of this room now... If there's a fire, it might be a good idea. But if somebody causes a stampede in a really busy place, lots of people get killed needlessly. right? So we shouldn't panic. Right now, the world uses about 80% carbon-based energy. So that's oil, natural gas, coal, things like that. And we use about 10% in the United States. 10% is about the number for 7%, actually. But it's reached as high as 10% for things like wind and solar and so on. Many politicians want to eliminate that 80%, all of it. Like Gordon Brown, who was formerly the Prime Minister in Great Britain, he said when he was in Copenhagen at a big climate change conference, we've got 50 days left. 50 days left to avert catastrophe. We have to act now. He's basically trying to get people to stampede. Prince Charles in 2011 said, our planet has reached a point of crisis and we have only 7 years before we lose all the levers of control. Well, here we are, 2018, and that's crazy. We've lost all the levers of control. No, we haven't. The environment's healthier. More people are eating better than ever before, and so on. Going green by cutting out coal or oil power, that's 80% of our power, would create enormous devastation. Let's think about your budget. Let's just cut out 80% of your budget right now and see how that works out for you. I think the solutions are worse than the potential problems. As an antidote then, let's just look back in time. This is a picture of a temperature chart from China. You can see the different dynasties. This is the year from Christ's birth to the year 2010 or so. And you can see the black line is showing you the temperature variation, and you can see it's going up and down and up and down. That's just northern China. And you can see similar things here in this temperature proxy chart of the past 5,000 years or so. A great deal of evidence relating to climate variation comes from proxy data, things like tree rings and sediments and ice cores and stuff like that. It's not real thermometers, right? There weren't people walking around in the time of the Emperor Constantine with thermometers measuring the temperatures, and then we can just record them over here. So what they do is they'll take things like tree rings and they'll look at how thick the tree ring is, and they'll say, okay, the temperature year was this much and the tree ring thickness is that much, and so this much thickness means this temperature. It's a very inexact science, but that's what people use to try to get these data. So what you can see from this, let's assume that this is reasonable. The global temperature is variable. It goes up and it goes down, and two steep features stand out here. There's the medieval warm period, there's the Roman warm period, there's a little ice age. We've got fairly good confidence in some of these things because we've got some other data. We may not have the exact temperatures, but we've got historical records. So, for instance, during the medieval warm period, it was well known that Great Britain, the British started cultivating vines. The Vikings moved to Greenland and were flourishing. But then during the Little Ice Age, the crops all failed. In Greenland, the climate was colder. Hardly any people produced grapes in the UK. The Thames became regularly frozen over. The elephants would walk on the Thames. They had big winter festivals. That hasn't happened now for several hundred years. I think the last ice festival they had on the Thames in London was in 1814. So that's over 200 years. So when we look at this, you would see why some politicians might not wish to talk about global warming, because it looks like temperatures in the past would have been a lot hotter than they are today on the far right. And I think that's the case. And so it would be foolish and useless to engage in hugely expensive and massively disruptive changes in life as we know it. Now, I do not deny climate change. If anybody looks at this, it's kind of obvious. Climate is always changing. Let's zoom in again. And here we can see measurements. And these are the temperature measurements with thermometers. You can see a little bit more. This is carbon dioxide measured in Hawaii. Carbon dioxide has definitely been going up, and it's because of human industrial development since World War II. And if we put these things together, the temperatures and the carbon dioxide, can you not see that the increase in carbon dioxide is definitely causing the increase in temperature? I'm not being serious. All right. I mean, you can see the ones going up, and it looks like the other one's kind of going up as well. But there's a problem with that. Right? The fact that we don't agree with that particular statement doesn't necessarily mean that we're blind or evil. It shouldn't mean that at all. I have a quick question for you, a quiz. Which major country has most successfully reduced its carbon dioxide emissions? You know which countries are green and which ones are not, right? What do you think? USA. None of these other countries, Japan, Germany, China, have decreased their carbon dioxide emissions. US emissions have actually hit a 25-year low. The carbon dioxide emissions emitted in the United States are today lower than they were 25 years ago. They're higher in Japan and Germany and China, all those countries who say, interesting. It's not because of Trump, President Trump, it's because of the shale revolution. We're using far less carbon-intensive fuels today. China is actually building 2 coal-fired power plants every single week, putting them online. Japan's building 26 in the next 10 years. They've got it all planned. So what's the primary hypothesis behind all this hysteria? And I'll try to go quickly here. It's that if the carbon dioxide is up, that the temperatures are going to go up. And there are 2 problems that I want to highlight here to show you how science can deconstruct this. The problems are, first, the false correlation, and the second one, the falsification by data. And here's a silly example to illustrate this. Here we have, on this vertical axis, global average temperature, and you can see from 1820 to the year 2000, it's been going up. Rough averages, right? On this horizontal axis is the number of pirates around the world. You can see that the number of pirates, which was 35,000 per year in 1820, has gone all the way down to 17 in the year 2000. What is this teaching us? It's very, very, very clear. Pirates of the world may very soon be asking for global warming reparations because, no, don't joke. If you look, human-produced carbon dioxide, this is the green curve. These are error bars, so we're not sure. We only have data for sure measured at Mauna Loa in Hawaii from the 60s. This is what human emissions of carbon dioxide look like. And look at the pirate numbers. They have been absolutely decimated. It's actually an inverse correlation. The more carbon dioxide you pump into the air, the fewer pirates, which I think is a good thing. But if you were a pirate, you would obviously not be pleased with that, would you? That's very flimsy evidence, isn't it? I mean, can we think of a few other reasons why there are few Barbary pirates right now? Just a few? Okay. So a more serious objection, and my final thing, is model falsification. Here are some of the data. And I had some real issues with the data. I'm glossing over them because there's technical details that I can't tell you about. I mean, really, the data that I would be happy with, that I really believe, would be from about here. And that's because of satellite data. When you're collecting thermometers over, right, what's the average temperature in this room? I could take everybody's temperature and say that's the average temperature. You have to have everybody uniformly distributed. We don't have thermometers uniformly distributed over the world, etc., etc., etc. There's thousands of problems we can talk about. But anyway, here are thermometer data. Let me point out this flat line. Can you see this from about the year 2000 right over there? It's definitely seems to be rising from the 70s up to about 1998, and since then, it's flatlined. The rise hasn't continued. It's flatlined. There's been no global warming if you're under 20 in your whole lifetime, even though you hear about it all the time as if it's the most serious thing. There's been no global warming in your lifetime. But let's look at the actual satellite measurements. So here are satellite measurements. These are real, pretty good data, most believable data that we have. And if we compare all of this to the carbon dioxide here in the green, right, you can see the carbon dioxide keeps going up. It's steadily going up. And we compare this to the satellite temperatures, you see that the increase in carbon dioxide is not matched by actual temperature accelerations. We keep hearing it's getting worse, unless we do something now, it's getting worse. It means that the acceleration of the warming what acceleration of the warming? The warming, there hasn't been warming for 20 years. So what are people talking about when they talk about the acceleration? Right? You can see the carbon dioxide goes up, temperature is going up. We know that doesn't necessarily mean a correlation, but maybe. But if that argument is what, if that's your primary hypothesis, you keep pumping more of this stuff in, well then the temperature should keep going up. They don't. They've stopped going up. In fact, they've just gone sideways for 20 years. So what is the reason for that? Why do people keep saying that? Ugly, ugly picture. Ugly. But it's the best I could come up with. You know, my local supermarket has great skill in knowing what I'm going to buy. Google and Facebook are studying your habits, selling your information to the governments, I suppose, and to corporations and so on, and they study very carefully your clicks and whatever you're doing. We use models, computer models and computer simulations to try to model things. And these are the results here. All these different lines are results of over 102 models, model simulations. The red line is the average temperature rise of all these models over time. And you can see, according to all the models, right, you take the average as the example, temperatures are skyrocketing. So when people say the temperatures are skyrocketing, they're skyrocketing in the video game. But in the real world, okay, we've got satellite data and some balloon data here in green and blue. It's not skyrocketing. In fact, there's a massive pull away from the actual video game compared to reality. So in a rational world, if the video game doesn't match reality, do you modify your thinking and match the video game, or do you say the video game's got it wrong? The video game has it wrong. And the reason is very simple, I think. I think it's because in all the models, in all the video games, they're saying the major component is carbon dioxide on, carbon dioxide off. That's what controls the temperature. Carbon dioxide is definitely going up, so the temperatures have to go up. But the real world is a lot more complex than that. It's a complex non-linear dynamical system that we're dealing with. Very, very complex. And so when it comes to how the actual climate system might respond to extra greenhouse gases, we don't actually have the proof of any of that. The climate's complexities are enormous and innumerable. So the primary hypothesis has failed. Carbon dioxide is not the most important. I'm not saying it's negligible, but it's certainly not the most important thing for climate. The models have it as the main driver, just like a radio with all these other dials turned off. The reality is far more complex, and that's the simple message that I want you to have. 400 parts per million is what we have right now, carbon dioxide outside. 1,000 parts per million would be kind of nice. But 400 is what we have. All right, thank you.